Ezekiel 38. Now, we're going to be talking a lot about it. In fact, we're going to be focusing on it, along with some other aligned prophecies. And the Middle East meltdown deals with current views of Gog and Magog. And there are several views. And you take them in order. You talk about who is Gog, what is Magog.
What I wanted to do is take something complicated and kind of, as J. Vernon McGee used to say, put the cookies on the bottom shelf and just allow people to, you know, read something that's simple and get a panorama of Bible prophecy.
Now, I'm going to just open right here to chapter 2. And there are current discussions about a series of wars that may lead to the Gog and Magog War. Now, even as we speak, we're sitting here today, the United States Army is moving toward Mosul in Iraq. The Russians have been bombing Aleppo. The Iranians are rapidly stoking their nuclear fires. The Saudis are arming themselves to the teeth. So essentially, we have the setting that Ezekiel 38 talks about. The words Gog and Magog, what do they mean? And let's just start there and let's begin by discussing those two words because they are, a riddle in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of those names, when you go to Ezekiel 38 verses 2-7, you see these strange names that we don't read about in the daily newspaper. You see names like Magog and Persia and Gomer and, So what I try to do in those early chapters is show that these names actually come, most of them, from Genesis 10, which is a table of nations, which is where Noah's, remember Noah ate in the ark.
Right.
The earth is repopulated after the global flood through those three lines. And you'll notice a lot of those names in Genesis 10. And when you get in touch with a couple of historians, one is Josephus, a very credible first century historian. Another one is Herodotus, who wrote not too long after the time of Ezekiel, a famous book called Histories. They basically show us where Noah's descendants settled. And so you can sort of track where those names and those people groups settled. And then it's just a matter of identifying the modern place of geography where these groups settled. And you can begin to identify, I believe, the nations that will be involved in this Gog-Magog war. So a lot of these names actually fit with the current newspaper when you understand that academic process that I just described.
Now, speaking of the academic process, when you think of Gog and Magog and a series of wars, you think of a timeline. You want to lay things out on a line. This happens here, this happens here. You come to that famous place in Ezekiel 39 that talks about the burning of weapons for 7 years, and your mind searches for a place to put the 7 years. And many different scholars have put the 7 years in different places. And so this is, I think, the beauty of studying Bible prophecy. If you don't try to be too dogmatic, if you study by the leading of the Lord, and he, as you say, he'll open the doors at the proper time, but never too soon.
Right.
And that's where we are right now. You have here the Gog and Magog War prophesied by Israel, the beginning of the millennium, idea. That is to say, the church is raptured, there is a tribulation, and then all the way up to the beginning of the millennium, that's when the Gog and Magog War would start.
Yeah, I try to lay out the different views and then explain my gentle disagreement with them and lay out what I think is the correct view at the end. But that would be one of the views that I don't think works for the primary reason that there isn't a war in the millennial kingdom until, of course, Satan is released from the abyss at the very end. So it's hard to identify the Gog-Magog War with events in the millennial kingdom itself, since the nations during that time were going to be beating their swords into plowshares. So I sort of do that with all the different views, you know, go through each one, describe where I think that view is, doesn't answer all the questions, and then get to what I think is the correct view.
I thought I'd start with that, and then the next view you mentioned is that the Gog-Magog War would be at the end of the millennium, because when you go to Revelation, you actually find the term Gog and Magog again.
Right.
So let's talk about that a minute.
Yeah, well, I have a difficult time putting it at the end of the millennium in that rebellion that happens at the end of the millennium, because that basically says all the nations are involved. In Revelation 27 through 9, when you study Ezekiel 38 and 39, it doesn't mention all the nations. It enumerates specific nations. And the big question is, well, why is the name Gog-Magog reused again by John in Revelation 27 through 9? And I kind of analogize it to, and I show you the source where this comes from, the concept of Waterloo. You know, we use the word, I've met my Waterloo all of the time. We're not saying the battle is being refought. We're analogizing it to something terrible in the past to describe a current struggle. So by the time you have that great invasion at the end of the millennium, the Gog-Magog war that's already happened in the past will be so well known and so well established that John sort of analogizes it to what the people would understand. So I'm not connecting the two wars.
So you're making it an idiom. Gog-Magog is kind of an idiom for a huge war.
Exactly.
A global war.
Exactly.
Interesting. I've read a number of Hebraic, linguistic explanations for Gog and Magog. Gog means roof. In just normal Hebrew parlance. And you think, roof, why roof? A roof is maybe a covering or, and then Magog would be, the Ma prefix on Gog would be from. And that makes no sense. And yet the idea of a roof is the idea of something covering something else. And perhaps that's what's intended, but nobody really knows what that term means.
I kind of look at Gog as the leader, and then Magog is one of the, I identify Magog as Central Asia, but, it's the leader of this coalition, Magog being one of the players there from Central Asia that's gonna invade Israel in the last days.
So, now we've kind of, laid out the terms here. Let's begin to discuss Ezekiel 38 and 39. Do you think this is imminent as we speak today? And here we are in 2016, the fall of 2016. And I'm not going to ask you to name a date or anything like that, but are we looking at something that's imminent as we speak?
Well, I struggle with using that word imminent, because the moment you say it's imminent is the moment you're basically saying something has to precede the rapture. The key of the next event on the prophetic horizon, from my understanding, is the rapture of the church. The New Testament tells us we're to be looking forward to Jesus. I'm not looking for an antichrist. I'm looking for, you know, Jesus Christ. And so people that put the war before the tribulation starts are usually pretty careful in their language, I've noticed, and I appreciate that. They say it could happen before the rapture, but doesn't have to happen before the rapture. So I prefer the term could or maybe rather than imminent, because the New Testament tells us that the next event on the horizon is the rapture of the church.
Well, I'm glad I used that word. I like the way you responded to that. That does, you know, kind of explain where we are today. There's a lot of panic. There's a lot of grasping at straws today. There are a lot of Christian groups that are making claims about timing, and there are those who are saying if you don't prepare, then you are just opening yourself to doomsday. And there's a lot of panic and a lot of, I think, perhaps unfounded speculation. Timelines go to the first half of the tribulation view of the Gog and Magog battle.
I think that view is partly right. I think it's difficult to put the whole thing in the first half of the tribulation, though. for the simple reason that chapter 39 is describing events that happen at the end. So it talks in chapter 39, verse 29. Also, I believe it's in verse 22 about the Spirit of God coming upon the Jewish people from that day on forever. That has to be something towards the end of the tribulation period, because that conversion of Israel is what is going to be used by God as the Jewish people call Jesus back to the earth. And he comes back to the earth at the end of the tribulation. So to put all of it in the first half, I think, is hard to maintain. I'm very open to the idea that chapter 38 could be in the first half. I sort of connect chapter 38 with the second seal judgment, because it's talking about an invasion during a time of peace, and that fits so nicely with Daniel 9:27, where the Antichrist comes to power and he enters into a peace treaty with national Israel, guaranteeing her survival. So this war takes place during that time of peace, but chapter 39 seems to be more of the aftermath of the war involving the conversion of Israel.
Second seal, that would be the red horse of war. And, you know, everybody thinks of red. The great communist armies of China, Russia, they associate the color red with themselves, the Red Army. We've all heard that term. And you see the red horse of war that sort of pops into your mind. I'm not saying that that is a fulfillment. I'm just making a suggestion here. And so you're associating Ezekiel 38 with the second seal. Now, that's the church is certainly not here when the second seal is opened, right?
Yeah, by the time the Antichrist comes forward and launches the seven-year tribulation period by entering into a peace treaty with unbelieving Israel, in order for that to happen, the restrainer, Paul tells us, 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 6 and 7, has to be removed. My interpretation is that we, the church, are that restrainer. The Holy Spirit is actually holding back Satan's man of the hour, who could be alive and well today, for all we know. But he's holding back that man from coming to global dominance through the presence of the church. But once the rapture happens, that restraint is gone. The Antichrist comes to power, enters into the peace treaty with Israel, and the second seal judgment, which I think is what Ezekiel 38 is talking about, comes into place after that event.
Now, again, and I have my Bible open to Ezekiel 38 and 39, and we talked about this before we sat down to make this program. You look at 37, the dry bones prophecy, and then 38, and you have Israel being the focus of an attack. 39, Israel is doing other things. And then you turn to 40, and you have the man with a measuring rod and the laying out of the kingdom. So all of these chapters seem kind of chronological.
Yeah, in fact, I would put chapters 33 through 48 as one unit. It really, when you study the timing of this, these prophecies were given after Jerusalem had finally fallen to Nebuchadnezzar. And the exiles in Babylon, you know, the people that Ezekiel is prophesying to, are without hope. So chapters 33, and you notice Ezekiel is recommissioned in chapter 33. Well, why is he recommissioned just like he was in chapter 3? To preach not judgment, but to preach restoration. And so all of those chapters are dealing with the restoration of Israel. Chapters 38 and 39 is describing the circumstances that Israel will be regenerated. And that's when they face this invading army that they couldn't hope to defeat unless they call upon God. And then they're converted. Chapter 39, verse 29 talks about the Spirit coming in them. And then, as you so well pointed out, then what follows is the millennium, the millennial kingdom, the temple, Ezekiel 40 through 48, the Dead Sea coming back to life. And so all of this would actually encourage these exiles that God has not forgotten his covenant with them.
As you're talking right now about the Middle East meltdown, I'm hearing kind of shades of the coming kingdom coming into this whole conversation. That the two go together, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, the Gog-Magog invasion is the catalyst that God uses to bring Israel to faith. And as she's in faith, God, who is not forgetful of his covenantal obligations to and through Israel, makes good on every single promise he ever made to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that glorious kingdom age follows, which is so masterfully articulated by Ezekiel right on through chapter 48. So it all goes together.
This locks Israel and the foundation of the kingdom age together.
They're connected.
They're very much connected.
Very connected. And what did God say all the way back in Genesis 12:3? I'll bless you, and through you the world will be blessed. And I like to refer to Israel as the gift that keeps on giving. There's more blessings coming.
Yes.
And that's the glorious kingdom age, which we're all looking forward to.
Here is what you call the two-phase view, in which the Gog and Magog prophecy begins at the beginning of the tribulation and then is in two phases, with the second one occurring at the end of the tribulation. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, that's a view I'd never heard of, and I credit one of my professors with that view. The first time he articulated it, I'd never heard it. It was Dr. Harold Honer, who's with the Lord now. I give you the footnote where you can find that particular view in his writings. But once I heard that view, I thought, this is it. Because the mistake I think that people make is they assume that chapters 38 and 39 happen simultaneously. And that really doesn't fit Ezekiel's prophecies. Most of Ezekiel's prophecies is describing a process. So what I'm seeing is chapter 38, the beginning of the war, connected with the second seal. Chapter 39 is the aftermath of the war, which really would happen towards the end of the tribulation period. That's why it talks about the birds of prey coming to feast on the corpses. Mm-hmm. That fits well with Matthew 24.
It does, yeah.
And Revelation 19, which are end time events. So 38 would be second seal. In my opinion, chapter 39 would be largely the aftermath of the war, which is a converted Israel, and that's where you have the burning of the weapons and the burying of the dead and things of that nature.
Let's go back to a verse. You and I talked about this before we came on today. One of the most amazing verses in the Bible to me is Ezekiel 38:18. It shall come to pass at the same time when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord God, that my fury shall come up in my face. Now, this really sounds tribulational to me. When God's fury comes up in his face, probably just another way of saying the wrath of God, the period of wrath. So comment on that, if you will.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, that's why you can't put this war, in my opinion, before the wrath of God starts. The book of Revelation is very clear. Jesus is in heaven. He is unsealing a seven-sealed scroll. And as those seals are broken, what is happening is yet another judgment is coming to the earth. And that starts in Revelation 6. Mm-hmm. He receives the seven-sealed scroll, which I believe is a title deed to the earth, in Revelation 5. But as those seals are opened, what does it say at the end of Revelation 6? The great day of his wrath has come. It's a time period that's not happening today. It's unique to that seven-year tribulation period. So the verse that you just cited fits so well within that time period. It doesn't fit within a time period where God is not pouring out his wrath.
Mm-hmm. And so this is a way of saying that maybe that second seal, the red horse, being a part of the early part of the tribulation, fits there.
Yeah, because you have a movement here in chapters 38, particularly 38, from peace to war. You go to Revelation 6, and the first seal is broken, and the rider on the white horse comes forth. He obviously brings peace to the earth of some sort, because the next seal, as it's opened, says peace was taken from the earth. So there's that same transition from peace to war. So maybe Ezekiel, and this is what I'm proposing, is talking about the same chronology that you find in the book of Revelation with the first two seal judgments.
And why not? it would make perfect sense that if you have a chronology in one place, there should be a chronology that, in another place that mm-hmm. would match it. Now, let's talk for a minute about the church and about the rapture of the church. So many people are discussing that these days, and I didn't necessarily plan on this when we sat down here, but I think this is a good time to talk about conversations concerning the pre-tribulation rapture of the church. Beg your pardon. Comment on that.
Well, we are a new man, a spiritual man called the church. We are given specific promises. We're never called Israel. The name Israel is used about 73 times in the New Testament. Never once is it applied to the church. It always refers to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, sometimes in faith, sometimes not in faith. So it's a technical word. And as the church, and we're not Israel, we're given promises, and one of those is we're not appointed under wrath. 1 Thessalonians 1:10, 1 Thessalonians 5:9. Romans chapter 5 and verse 9, Romans chapter 8 verse 1, how many verses can we cite here? And what is the tribulation period? It's a time of wrath for Jacob. So if we're not appointed under wrath and we're not the nation of Israel, we cannot be in that time period. And that's why when you study all of these passages related to the Great Tribulation period, you don't find any references to the church in that time period. You don't find any references to the body of Christ in that time period. So what we're talking about here, understanding God's separate purposes for Israel and the church, really builds the case for a pre-tribulational point of view.
The coming Islamic invasion of Israel. We haven't talked about Islam yet. Huge factor, divisive factor. People are arguing about Islam. What is Islam? What are they up to? What are their motives, et cetera, et cetera. Why do you involve Islam in this discussion?
Well, from where I sit, Islam furnishes the theological motivation for the attack. And the reason I say that is because in Islamic doctrine, Jerusalem is a holy site. Now, I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek because the word Jerusalem is not found in the Quran a single time. But it is found in the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, at least 800 times. Oh. But at any rate, they believe that that is where Muhammad ascended back to Allah. And so it's what they would call a holy site. And any time Muslims rule over a territory, they believe that that territory unconditionally belongs to Allah. That's why Israel doesn't appear on most Middle Eastern maps. And so as you study these various nations involved in this invasion, what you discover, maybe with the exception of Russia or Rosh, that an Islamic thread runs through all of them. And so I believe the spread of Islam throughout that region of the world, and really throughout most of the world, is furnishing the theological motivation for this coming attack. You have to understand that Israel, in Islamic thought, is a usurper. It doesn't belong there. And so, because that's Allah's territory.
It just so happens that a few days ago, as this program is being made, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, voted to officially separate any reference to the Temple Mount from Israel. So the Temple Mount is no longer an Israeli artifact. And UNESCO has ruled to that effect.
Yeah, I didn't know you could vote facts out of existence. It's like taking a vote to disband the law of gravity or something like that. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's a historical fact. You can't divorce Israel from that land. It's impossible.